protagonist of Alex Gilvary's debut novel is Boy Hernandez, a 25-year-old dress designer who's moved to New York City from his native Philippines, hoping to make it big in the fashion industry. Boy is talented and ambitious, but hopelessly naive, and he runs afoul of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security when he unknowingly bankrolls his clothing line with money a neighbor has made from shipping weapons to Somalia. Alex Gilvary was on our show in January to discuss From the Memoirs of an Enemy Combatant, which Booklist has called a timely and touching triumph, and we thought we would re-air that conversation for you today. Boy arrives in New York City in 2002 after graduating from a fashion school in Manila, and a couple of years later he becomes the first person apprehended on U.S. soil ever to be sent to the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I ask Alex Gilvary, did you create Boy Hernandez to illustrate your concerns about the post-9/11 immigrant experience in New York City?
I did, very much so. You know, that was my intention. I wanted to write a story about an immigrant living in New York City post 9/11, both about immigration and then for him to experience, what's going on in detention.
And the suspension of habeas corpus, you say, was a concern.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned that in the book, to be, locked away without due process.
Although your book is clearly a novel and Boy is your invention, you've included a lot of details about the fashion industry and about New York that are clearly drawn from reality. How did you come to write a novel about the fashion industry?
Well, I was working in Soho for a children's publisher for many years, from like 2004 to 2007, and it was just something that surrounded me in that very fashionable neighborhood. I'd go to lunch and I'd see models going to and from their castings. I'd see designers like Marc Jacobs on the street. So it was just surrounded me at all times. And I wanted to take a kind of a superficial person, or seemingly superficial person, and catapult him into the realities of today.
And I'm assuming you have to do a bit of research.
Yeah, I did. You know, I started shopping at some high-priced boutiques.
Shopping is research.
That was research. You know, I could expense that. And then he's a fashion designer of women's wear, so I just read everything I thought he would read as a designer. I read women's fashion magazines and tried to learn how to write about women's clothing.
And his biggest fear is that someday he might be forced to have to design for weddings.
Yeah, bridal wear. That was
Is that the bottom rung of
No,
fashion?
It's not. It's just a kind of a running joke in the novel. Everybody tells him, you know, you don't want to be working in bridal wear for the rest of your life, you know.
Well, it seems like you had fun poking at the making jokes at the expense of the pretentious language that's used in fashion magazines and by designers to describe their clothing. But you also play with the terms the government uses to describe what's going on in Guantanamo.
Yeah, you know, Gitmo has their own lexicon that was pretty amazing to me. It was a way to dehumanize the prisoners, to dehumanize everything that's going on there. And so there's so much language that's being created there, like a hit to a prisoner is a non-injurious act. You know?
And these are real terms? You obviously researched Gitmo.
Yeah. I've read everything I could about Gitmo, some great books over the last 10 years by Gitmo lawyers and detainees themselves, memoirs. And, I had a notebook full of terms that, I learned and wanted to use and investigate.
We should point out that this book is described as a dark comedy. It is very funny.
Yes.
So you get fun. You even get humor out of different ways of saying suicide, something that you don't normally think of as being funny.
Right. Yeah. It's not. I mean, it's not. There's nothing funny about it. It's darkly funny. Suicide. There were so many terms that the military has for it, like SIB, which is a self-injurious behavior. That's
they
suicide.
They call it SIB?
SIB. Yeah. There's no. Nobody says suicide there. You know. It's a way of maybe covering things up and making it nice.
Did your own experiences after 9/11 play a role in your decision to write this, and also making your character Filipino, because you're partly a Filipino?
Yeah, I'm half Filipino. My mother's from the Philippines. It played a great role. I was 20. I was a student at Hunter College during 9/11, and then you know, the city changed very much, and you know, I would see tanks and military on my way to school, and I was just a budding writer at the time, and I really wanted to write about this place because it was changing so much.
But you also say you were stopped by police, your backpack was searched on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Something that doesn't happen to someone who looks like me.
No.
Did they think that you looked Middle Eastern?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, getting on planes. Nobody knew quite what to make of me because I'm half Filipino, I'm very tall, and I have a Scottish last name, so it's very confusing for people sometimes.
Do you think that day-to-day life for immigrants in New York has changed since 9/11 in ways that most Americans, especially those living outside of New York City, aren't even aware of?
I think so. I think it's definitely changed. You know, it's changed for us, too, the way we look at immigrants. You know, just on my ride here, you know, I was observing a woman, you know, in a full burqa. And you, your eye is now different, what goes through your head. This is something I wanted to investigate in the book, in the novel.
My guest is Alex Gilvary. His novel is called From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant. Boy is your protagonist's name. Nickname for Boyette. Is that a common name in the Philippines?
Boy is a very popular name. It's almost like John here, you know. Boyette is a popular name. Boy is a popular name, but it's also a popular nickname there. I have like several cousins named Boy, and if your name has a B in it, like Reuben, your family might call you Boy.
Well, it has a pejorative meaning, especially in regard to African Americans in this country. Mm. So, was choosing that name a way of letting readers know that the character would end up at a disadvantage?
You know, I don't think that was intentional. I think I wanted to make this character sort of an everyman, you know, but an every immigrant, so to speak. So, you know, Boy was just that perfect way to do it, that name.
And you tell the story through him.
Yes.
Now, it becomes clear that he isn't, as they say, the sharpest knife in the drawer. And that was a decision you made from the start, to not make him, to make him a bit naive?
Yeah, I wanted him to be naive. I mean, he's a lot like myself. I'm naive, you know, in many ways, too. But he's, you know, people call him an unreliable narrator, and he is. The novel is his memoir, written from prison as he prepares for his tribunal.
A kind of confession.
Yeah, it's a confession. It's a confession written out to his federal interrogator. And he, you know, I send up the memoir in a lot of ways because, you know, he's remembering the things the way we remember them. You know, memory is not very reliable, and either is his. And so the novel's footnoted by an editor with a particular interest in Boy's story, who's always correcting him on certain details.
One of the first people Boy meets after he arrives in New York is Ahmed Qureshi, a businessman who becomes the sole financial backer of his clothing line. Does Boy have any concern about working with Qureshi, about whom he knows very little?
You know, he doesn't. He's a man who's very wrapped up in his own haute couture bubble, you know, and he's just very concerned about his career, and he
None of their financial arrangements are in writing. They don't even save receipts.
No, they don't save receipts. He's just given lots of money to launch this label because he believes, or he wants to believe, that this man Ahmed really believes in his talent.
And Boy assumes that Ahmed is Pakistani. Doesn't worry him until Ahmed said this, that he's from Canada,
yes.
Which he really is.
Yes, he's a the character of Ahmed's also a pathological liar, and this is why Boy. One of the reasons Boy, in a way, starts to trust him because everything out of his mouth is a lie.
It's difficult to know how to characterize this novel. Reviewers have referred to it as a dark comedy, as a farce, a satire. How did you think of it when you were writing it? Because you must have, some of these things must have made you laugh out loud as you thought of them.
Yeah, I think of it as a satire, a dark satire. The reviewers are right in saying that. It is very funny, and I do laugh when I write. I make myself laugh. I write a lot of one-liners. You know, many of those had to come out because they don't really work for novels. But it is funny, but with very serious notes.
Well, Boy's description of detention even is funny at times. He's given a copy of the Quran and a prayer rug when he arrives at Guantanamo, even though he tells him that he's a Catholic, not a Muslim.
Yeah, he's a Catholic, but they give him the religious paraphernalia like everybody else. And he sits in his cell reading the Quran all day, which is the only book he has.
He also cuts off the sleeves of his orange jumpsuit to make it look more stylish.
Yeah, he doesn't like the way it sort of fits, and it's very hot down there, so he gets rid of the sleeves, and he's punished for that in the book.
But the tone, I don't want to give too much away, but the tone does turn dark at the end.
It does, especially during the last third of the novel as Boy's tribunal approaches. He begins to lose hope in the American justice system, and he begins to wonder how long he'll be there. You know, he's detained indefinitely. He doesn't know, you know. Nobody tells him. And that's really the subject I wanted to get at. This is sort of a worst-case scenario.
Well, he is unfairly charged. In an earlier time, we had Coco Chanel, who did collaborate with the Nazis and got away with it.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I mentioned in the book and that I found in my research, that Coco was involved with the Nazis, and she was, charges were sort of dismissed.
Because the British royal family asked for them to be dropped.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She was very close to Churchill, I believe. I mean, it's unfortunate she picked the wrong side. But no, nothing happens like that for Boy. But I knew I was on the right track with this novel, that something like this could happen with a fashion designer.
Now, you grew up in Staten Island?
Yeah, I was born and raised.
And did the diversity of Staten Island have any kind of impact on the way you see the world?
Absolutely. You know, for me, you know, coming into Manhattan for the first time when I was a teenager, going here, you know, by myself to see films, it was very much an immigrant to the city. I had to learn it just like everybody else.
A lot of kids who live in the other boroughs say, "I'm going into the city."
Yeah, it's the city. You know, it's the big city that you're going. It's an all-day affair. You know, you take the 2-hour ferry. You know, 2-hour commute, and you spend all day here.
Well, let's hope that you're not arrested and sent to Guantanamo.
I hope not. Yeah, thank you.
Alice Gilvary's novel, From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard.